Welcome to In the Studio, a 21st century look at history's greatest rock stars. Redbeard here in the studio for part one of the 5 years from 1969 to 1973 in the long, colorful career of David Bowie.
The spin of the 50s, where everything was answerable, where there was good, there was bad, there was negative, there was positive, that everything was easy to quantify and easy to put into categories, broke down in the 70s. There was suddenly a feeling that there were at least two sides to every question. I think that the person that I was listening to out of America as much as Little Richard by that time would have been Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground. And so, that you know, those are sort of both ends of where I was at, from Lou Reed to Scott Walker. And then all these other weird things in between, you know, everything from sort of avant-garde movies to bits of theatre that I caught, Harold Pinter, Kabuki Japanese theatre. It was a ball of knotty string. Gene Genie lives on his back. Gene Genie loves chimney stacks. It partially became because I enjoy theatrical music. I enjoy the idea of interpreting things on stage and creating an otherness of some kind, creating another kind of world. How could they know? This is David Bowie in the studio.
The irony in the David Bowie backstory of the 5 years from 1969 to 1973, as you will hear in this classic rock interview with Bowie and the late guitarist arranger Mick Ronson, is that Rono points out that the Ziggy Stardust album and U.S. tour in summer 1972 did not sell very well, at least not initially, which producer Ken Scott confirms in his book, and I quote, "While many of the initial dates were indeed successful, Bowie mania had not taken hold in all parts of the U.S., as dates in Houston and Oklahoma City were canceled due to lack of ticket sales. And there was a concert in St. Louis that had attendance so small, only 180 people in an 11,000-seat hall, that David Bowie gave what amounted to a private show. But as the tour progressed, so did the buzz. By the second time, in cities such as Philadelphia and Cleveland, he, Bowie, was selling out 10,000-seat venues." Ken Scott writes, "Since then, Rolling Stone magazine writers have ranked the Ziggy Stardust album at number 35 on their top 500 albums of all time. We're talking ahead of Hotel California, debuts from The Doors and the Sex Pistols, ahead of Dark Side of the Moon, Bridge Over Troubled Water, and Meet the Beatles and Please Please Me. David Bowie changed the trajectory of rock music, fashion, and gender social issues in just 38 minutes with Ziggy Stardust." As a young impressionable student, then known as David Robert Jones, Bowie was fortunate to receive instruction in art from a teacher in London with the surname Frampton, whose own son Peter would make his mark later in the music world too. Here's David Bowie with me in the studio.
His father was my art master. Peter Frampton's father, Professor Frampton, was he got me into the artistic mode at a very young age. He was great. He was a terrific man. Incredibly inspirational and a real help in the bleakness of a useless academic life. There was some spark of hope with Frampton Senior. And because of him, I guess, he really gave me the option that one can sort of have a creative career. It wouldn't have to be sort of, you know, I thought like the rest of the people that lived around me and the guys that I knew, it would be some kind of real blue collar job, which is fine, which is okay. I just didn't want one. That's it. It's as simple as that. And he did show me that there was a way of sort of turning an artistic side into some kind of career. And initially I thought I was either going to be a painter, but I realized there was absolutely no money in that. So for work, I became a graphics artist, a commercial artist. And that was going on parallel to me playing in R&B bands in the evenings. In the evenings I'd sort of dodge back to my apartment, grab my saxophone, because I was playing saxophone then, and go out and play R&B.
The R&B rage that Bowie found himself swept up in was the same English primordial musical swamp that spawned the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, The Who, and the Yardbirds.
It was a very exciting period in Britain because all the blues artists would come. There was this sort of upsurge because of bands like the Stones and Yardbirds, and they'd sort of revived this incredible interest in blues and rhythm and blues. And so artists who weren't working too much in the States were flooding over to Britain and really working out over there, going up and down Britain to all the major cities and getting themselves, suddenly all their careers had been reignited. Mm-hmm. It was fantastic to be able to see Muddy Waters and Jimmy Witherspoon, Jimmy Reed and Sonny Terry, Brownie McGee and all these guys. It was just unreal. Mm-hmm. Here they all were, virtually all playing up one street in London. Wow. Every night of the week for like months. It was just like, it was heaven for us, you know. It definitely was the land of milk and honey for me in a creative way. I was introduced to the American writers and jazz musicians really when I was very young, I guess. When I was kind of 9, 10, I was given books on Jack Kerouac and Ferlinghetti and Ginsberg and Corso and all that whole beat crowd.
Right.
And they became sort of early Bibles for me. And because of their books, I got into jazz and Eric Dolphy and the whole Coltrane thing. And a lot of it I never really quite understood, but the feeling in there was enough to move me toward thinking that America is the place where real breaking away can happen, where you can really go after a kind of a dream, you know. And then because of the jazz, naturally I discovered blues and rhythm and blues and all that. So it opened up so many avenues for me in ways that one can express oneself. So those were the early things.
Reflecting worldwide fascination with the first lunar landing that summer, plus the Stanley Kubrick film 2001 A Space Odyssey, the title song, Space Oddity, from David Bowie, features a pre-Yes Rick Wakeman on Mellotron, just months before Rick joined Yes. When Rolling Stone magazine listed their top 500 albums of all time, David Bowie's third album, Hunky Dory, was listed at an impressive 108. Bowie himself pointed to it as significant in his development as a songwriter.
Of course, it also cemented a real good relationship with Mick Ronson on that album. We'd started working together on an album before, Man Who Sold the World. But we really sort of realized that we were collaborating in a very strong way. I think, interestingly enough, the one thing that maybe I learned from doing Hunky Dory is that how oriented I was toward narrative, and that I had a natural inclination to develop little scenarios and characters. Even though there were no real characters on Hunky Dory, the idea of developing little story songs as opposed to sort of just mood pieces, it obviously was quite strong in me. And I think it gave me the motivation to propel myself towards something that was a lot sort of more cohesive as an album, that virtually took one storyline and developed it and gave it different moods. So it might have been Hunky Dory probably for me was a first recognition that I had this ability to write stories that people found interesting. Yeah, that's probably more than anything else.
Throughout his illustrious career, David Bowie has exhibited a keen ear for guitarists, starting with a gardener from the northern English county of Yorkshire named Mick Ronson.
We kind of looked like brothers or something because we both had long blonde hair, you know. We also had like a similar sort of look, you know. We kind of looked like brothers or something, you know. So that's how come Hunky Dory sounds acoustic, because it went from the numbers being done as an acoustic sort of duo to bringing in a bass player and a drummer again, which was like Trevor and Woody, you know. Then it started to get more electric because there was more of a band there all the time. So then when we got to Ziggy Stardust, it was like the band with Woody and Trevor, but it was much more electric again because we'd gone through the acoustic thing, because we still wasn't doing the acoustic thing, so it moved back to electric because of the bass playing and drumming all the time. So that's how come them albums sounded really sort of different, you know.
Changes appeared on David Bowie's 1970 album, Hunky Dory. When we come back, David Bowie credits two widely divergent American rockers as huge influences. These historic years, 1969-1973, covering an amazing 10 albums by David Bowie, have been boxed as a 12 CD or 13 vinyl records, plus 128-page booklet and the highly collectible Recall 1 double disc of non-album Bowie singles, single versions, and B-sides. David Bowie, 5 years, 1969 to 1973, is just a click away at Amazon. I'm Redbeard, and you're in the studio with David Bowie.
Hi, this is David Bowie, and I'm in the studio for the rise and fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars.
Thank you, David. I'm Redbeard. At the time of its release in June 1972, Ziggy Stardust made David Bowie into the hottest rock star on the planet. It was the beginning of glam rock's heyday, a record and success story based as much on Bowie or Ziggy's persona as it was on the music. In fact, most of the attention then in the British press was focused on things other than music: Bowie's clothes, his sensuality, the outrageousness of it all. But it's likely that all the hype, all the packaging, would have been wasted if the music hadn't been so good. Rolling Stone magazine put The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars in the number 35 spot in its top 500 albums of all time. They didn't do it because of David's hairstyle. This was powerful music, a more successful combination of the elements of theater and rock that had ever been attempted. As a rock fable, the story of stardom and its capacity for self-destruction, it worked much better than The Who's Tommy.
It all gets rather complex, actually. I think that the person that I was listening to out of America, as much as Little Richard, by that time would have been Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground. They were incredibly important to me. I was lucky to get to hear them very early on. I got to hear them before the Americans did. A friend of mine brought back from America, he knew Warhol, and he paid a trip over to New York, and Warhol gave him an acetate. Of this band that he'd just sort of been involved with, and said, you know, see what you can do with this for British, see if you can get this a release in England on some label. And the guy came back and said, listen, I found this really crappy piece of work that Warhol gave me. It's all noise, there's no songs on it. And like a fool, he gave it to me, and I got a whole new lease on life. I thought, this is really cool. I want to sound like this, but English. So it sort of, that became part of my major influences at that time. Also, on top of that, at the other end of the pole, an American singer called Scott Walker, who'd abandoned America and had come to live in Britain. And he had two guys with him, and they called themselves the Walker Brothers.
The Walker Brothers were American?
The Walker Brothers were from Southern California.
I had no idea. I always thought they were British. How about that?
And so, that, you know, those are sort of both ends of where I was at, from Lou Reed to Scott Walker. And then all these other weird things in between, you know, everything from sort of avant-garde movies to bits of theatre that I caught, Harold Pinter, Kabuki Japanese theatre. It was a real complex, it was a ball of knotty string. And there were all these threads running through all of culture, and it didn't really matter which art form it came from, that I felt could be developed for record and stage and make rock something other than what it was at the time. More representative of what contemporary culture felt like, I guess. That was, you know, it's kind of art with a big A.
Gotcha.
I suppose.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll tell you one quite amusing thing maybe about Moonage Daydream. The solo in it is a baritone and it was supposed to have been Fife, but we couldn't find anybody that played Fife. So I think I ended up playing Penny Whistle. So it's baritone, sax, and Penny Whistle.
Wow.
And I got that combination of instruments from, dig this, the B-side of the Hollywood Argyles' Alley Oop. On the other side was a song called Sure Know Lot About Love. Wow. And the solo of that was Fife and baritone, sax. And I thought, that is the greatest combination of instruments. It's so ludicrous.
Wow.
You've got this tiny little sparrow of a voice on top and this huge grunting pig ox of a thing at the bottom. I do remember that. At that period, I was releasing two albums a year. I mean, it was nothing to release two albums a year at that time. It's, I don't know, I do. I find work not easy, but really satisfying. And I think when you enjoy something that much, you kind of do it as much as you can. Bit like sex, Redbeard. And it wasn't until much later I realised that all the things that I loved, Jimmy Dean, Blue Jeans, well, not Blue Jeans these days, of course, but at that time,
right,
everything that I loved were the rejects of America. They were the things that the establishment actually didn't want people to really recognise. For me, they were the great things about America.
It was another of the first generation American rock and rollers that came to mind immediately when David Bowie appeared on his 1971 album cover, The Man Who Sold the World, wearing a dress. Not since Little Richard had a rocker projected such ambiguity in sexuality. Here's the Spiders band leader, the late guitarist Mick Ronson.
While we're still playing duets, we got into wearing dresses, and we'd wear dresses on stage and start using a lot of makeup and stuff, you know. And then from there, it went into more of a, like, it's kind of a rock band. But as Ziggy was getting put together, then the ideas of the costumes still kept coming. So it developed into some other area, you know. He was always, like, you know, like kind of fashion conscious and setting trends. And Angela had a lot to do with that, Angela Bowie, you know, because she was real sort of outgoing like that. And she was, like, all for, like, dressing up and being real flamboyant and everything, you know. The dress sense was always there, you know. It just kind of went through different stages. I mean, David had come floating around in a dress, you know, like, in the middle of the afternoon, like, for no reason, you know what I mean? And I'm thinking, like, what the hell is going on here, you know? I mean, you would, you know, I mean, like, I'm a Yorkshire man, you know what I mean? I'm from the north of England, you know? It's like, you know, it was really, I really enjoyed dressing up too, you know, and everything. But, I mean, then it got, like, you know, you dress up before you go on stage, you dress up to go on stage and stuff, you know what I mean? But then it just become a whole daily life, you know.
Up next, we'll find out the actual true life inspiration for the character of Ziggy Stardust. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio for the 5 years from 1969 to 1973 with David Bowie.
Hi, this is David Bowie, and I'm in the studio for the rise and fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars.
We know that Ziggy's was the name of a London tailor shop David spotted from the window of a train. Stardust was nicked from a country singer in Texas who called himself the legendary Stardust Cowboy and innocently appeared in earnest on American television, but the show's producers played him strictly for laughs. But there was an unforgettable real-life character from which David Bowie drew inspiration for his character, Ziggy Stardust.
The most important ingredient in all this was a loony American called Vince Taylor.
Vince Taylor?
Vince Taylor was a would-be Elvis who didn't do so well in the States. So, yet again, he came over to England. It's the big fish, small pool syndrome. And he came over and tried to do a bit of an Elvis in Britain, and it didn't go down that well. So he ended up in France, where he became major and a contender to Johnny Hallyday for the title, in fact. While he was in England, I got to meet him, and I hung out with him. He was out of his tree.
Really?
The guy was genuinely deluded.
Really?
He would like wear white robes occasionally, and we'd be walking down really major streets in London, and then he would just stop and drag out a map of London and show me where all the Martians were going to land. And we'd be kneeling there in the middle of rush hour traffic, poring over maps and finding out where the saucers are going to land. And then Vince, so that was an introduction to a new way of looking at maps, as well as rock and roll. Then Vince went to France and formed a rock band, but ended his career a few years later by coming on stage, again in his white robes, and declaring that he had finished in rock because he'd just been told he was Jesus Christ. And that was the end of Vince Taylor in France. Unfortunately, he's no longer with us. I died a few years ago.
Oh, I'm sorry, but you know, when you've got that Christ gig, you don't really need anything else.
You don't really need it, no. Although he did need a hospital at the end of his life to support his illusions.
That's allusions. Yeah.
And so Vince sort of became a very vital ingredient to the whole idea of the Ziggy Stardust guy.
Meanwhile, back at the music, the key to the album's power was clearly Mick Ronson and his guitar. Suffragette City, Rolling Stone magazine said, was a whole new level of guitar rock aggression, end quote. Mick Ronson also wrote the album's string arrangements and used a bevy of fuzz boxes and wah-wah pedals. On stage, Mick Ronson played an equally important role, not just for his guitar playing, but as the macho alternative to the sexually ambiguous Ziggy character. The Spiders from Mars wouldn't have worked without Mick Ronson.
And I'm a very sort of electric player too, you know. I'm not a very clever player or anything. I mean, if I hit a chord, I really want to hit it as hard as, you know. I mean, I really like mean to hit that chord, you know. I don't like playing about with it. And when I play a guitar, I really like to play the thing from the heart or something, you know. Otherwise, I don't think there's much point in playing it. We can always play like these nice little things and play like these nice little parts and stuff like that, and put a bit of chorus in on it and make it sound real pretty. You know what I mean? I always thought Pete Townsend was the greatest rhythm guitar player ever, you know, because of the way he hits them chords. I mean, when that guy hit that guitar, he hit that thing. I mean, no missing, you know. And that, to me, was, like, fantastic, you know. That's, to me, is how you should play guitar, you know. I don't piddle around with a thing, you know. Get all of it and play it, you know. It's like Jimi Hendrix did the same thing. And that's how I wanted to play guitar. I wanted to play it, like, there's no mistaking. Here I am playing guitar, you know. Not sit there all studiously, you know what I mean? And playing all these nice little things, you know. I mean, I kind of, you know, I like to hit the thing, you know.
David Bowie returns next week in the studio to cover the albums Aladdin Sane and Pinups. These historic years, 1969 through 1973, covering an amazing 10 albums by David Bowie, have been boxed as 12 CDs or 13 vinyl records, plus a 128-page book and the highly collectible Recall 1 double disc of non-album Bowie's singles, single versions, and B-sides. David Bowie, 5 years, 1969 to 1973, is just a click away now at Amazon. I'm Redbeard. I'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guest David Bowie, who returns at the same day and time next week. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, and written by Joe Rhodes for Beard to Fish Productions. Copyright 2015, all rights reserved. Transcription, Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter, at Redbeard Rocks, and online at inthestudio.net.